We return to the Symphonies of Beethoven. This is Lecture 8, the second of two lectures dealing with Beethoven's Symphony No. 2 in D major, Opus 36. Lecture is entitled Beethoven at the Edge, and what he's at the edge of course, is the classical style, this wonderful urbane style filled with beautiful tunes and artistic restraint. Beethoven's piece is not nearly as tuneful and certainly not as restrained as some of the classical pedants would have it be, and indeed it is in the Second Symphony that Beethoven really goes almost beyond the classical style, a style he will leave completely behind in his Third Symphony of 1803. We are listening at this point to the exposition of the first movement of Beethoven's Number 2, and this is what I want us to notice while listening to the exposition. We'll hear both themes plus the connecting modulating bridge and the ensuing cadence material. I want us to notice how lengthy and varied this exposition is, especially after the long introduction that preceded this exposition. I want us to notice the tremendous variety of moods and musics that come one after the other at us. I want us to notice the extraordinary rhythmic energy of this exposition and indeed of the entire Second Symphony. The last things I would point out about the exposition before we do our listening are the modulating bridge at measure 61. Explosive, high-momentum music breaks free of theme 1, consists of two angular phrases, each of which falls and then rises. I would also point out the cadence material is in three parts, and it ends with a gentle descent, which will bring us back to the exposition repeat if we're hearing it for the first time, or to the development if we're hearing it for the second time. Let's dig in and let us realize that the variety of moods, the variety of musics, the tremendous rhythmic energy really doesn't sound like Haydn. It doesn't sound like Mozart. If I may, for a moment, paraphrase Dorothy on her arrival in Oz. Toto, this doesn't sound like the classical era anymore. Well, on that, you can bet your ponytail, doll. Let's check it out. From Theme 1, the exposition. Measure 57. Modulating bridge. Theme 2, A. A prime. B. Measure 102. Cadence material. Part 2. Part 3. And then onwards to the development, which is where we're going now. Now, I hope my voiceovers aren't causing too much duress for those of you who are listening. I do this so that you have a chance of following the word score through those sections of the movements we've done ourselves. Again, I can't encourage you enough to go out and buy recordings of these symphonies without the annoying voiceovers, but with all of the music that you could then sit down and listen to, hopefully with an extremely heightened consciousness, both to its expressive content and structurally what's going on. All right, onwards to the development section, which is the heart and soul of this movement. This development exhibits a degree of contrast, of drama, of depth and expression that go far beyond anything we heard in Beethoven's First Symphony, or frankly, pretty much beyond anything we would have heard in any other classical symphony up to this point. It is a development section in 8 parts, and we'll divide it and listen to the dramatic first part, or parts 1 through 5, and the dramatic second half, parts 6 through 8. So I would read from your word score some of the important things we should notice in parts 1 through 5. But what I really want you to notice, again, my friends, is contrast, drama, momentum, above and beyond the restrained nicety of the classical style. Part 1, brief. The exposition-ending cadence and descending winds are heard again, though now redirecting the harmony to part 2. Theme 1 motive, yabba-dabba-dum, in low strings, sequenced upwards. Again, please remember the word sequence. It means when a motive is repeated, but at different pitch levels. Those were sequences of the original idea, and it's an important way of elongating a melodic idea into a much longer melodic idea, which forces harmonies to change and a sense of progress to take place, even as you're using the same melodic idea over and over again, but always in a different pitch place. Part 3, sequence of theme 1 motives imitated between low and high strings, back and forth, and you'll notice we're in a minor key. The dark mood of the introduction, that D minor moment of the introduction, has again revisited the music. Part 4, dramatic passage sees theme 1 motive imitated between winds and violins over a chromatically descending bass line. Very dramatic, often evocative of death in the music of other composers, this bass line again gives a tremendous sense of momentum and movement to the music that is occurring above it. Part 5, the tension grows. Low strings and bassoon join the imitative fray. Descending upper string tremolos. Strings are going back and forth on their instruments. Push the growing tension further forward until finally we reach a pedal harmony, a sustained harmony. The dark mood brightens as the music slowly quiets. That's a good chunk. Let's jump in. Development section, parts 1 through 5. Part 2. Part 3. Part 4. Part 5. And let's catch our breaths for a moment. Beethoven has ease off for a brief moment, and we need the respite to revive, get some blood sugar back in before the next onslaught. Look, almost everything we heard just now was that theme 1 motive, yabba-dabba-dum, which again, seemingly banal idea used to unbelievable ability by Beethoven. The point is, the energy level, the degree of contrast, the sense of harmonic motion here goes way beyond anything we heard in the First Symphony with its fairly stock sequences and predictable turn of events. Parts 6 through 8 of the development. Part 6, a brief glimpse of theme 2. Oh, the most brief glimpse. Beethoven doesn't want to bother with theme 2 right now. Part 7, sequence built on the final ascending portion of theme 2, heard in part 6. The winds alternate with embellished triplet violins, and this builds to another climax, part 8, dramatic development of the rising triadic dotted rhythm opening of theme 2. And now theme 2 truly comes back. The dotted rhythms, when isolated and repeated, as they are here, remind us more and more of the coup d'archet rhythm that initiated the piece in the introduction. Ba-bum! Stirring coup d'archets and strings and winds heard over wide-ranging arpeggios in the second violins bring us to an open cadence. The violins descend, and thank goodness we're home. Back to D major, back to theme one, back to harmonic stability in the recapitulation. Development parts 6 through part 8, and the opening of the recapitulation, please. Part 7. Part 8. It's a marvelous development section which gives semi-equal time to the themes. It doesn't mix the themes. Parts 1 through 5 focus on theme 1, and parts 6 through 8 focus on theme 2. All right, the recap goes pretty much according to Hoyle. Theme 2 will now occur in the home key of D major, which is what we expect. So what I would do is direct our attention to the coda. It is a rather lengthy coda in 6 parts. It balances the lengthy introduction and builds to a powerful and invigorating conclusion. Quickly, part 1, a sequence of descending wind ideas. Part 2, a sequence of overlapping dialogue between theme 1 and a gentle descending motive. Part 3, another dialogue. Part 4, extraordinary series of tutti harmonies heard over a tension-building, rising chromatic bass line that rises from a D all the way up to an E, well more than an octave above, and then part 5, full speed ahead. High energy, highly syncopated, which means all kinds of accents occurring all over the place. Music resembles a non-modulatory version of the bridge, part 6, theme 1 motive, yabba-da-ba-dum, heard in a gigantic orchestral unison. Everyone in the band is playing the same thing. Cadence chords heard in the rhythm of the coup d'archet bring the movement to a stirring conclusion. Energy, energy, more energy. Rock and roll, my friends. Let's listen to the coda, part 1. Part 2. Part 3. Part 4. Part 5. Part 6. All right, some conclusions regarding this movement, which of course we have not spent nearly enough time with. However, we've spent enough to draw our conclusions. The movement exhibits a scope, a degree of contrast, and a rhythmic physicality that take it to the very outer edge of what we think of as the classical style, a style which assumes balance and artistic restraint. I didn't hear a lot of artistic restraint, and when Beethoven wanted to plug in an odd section of music, particularly when he plugged in that bit of theme 1 motives at measure 102 of the exposition, for example, he does it. He does it because he wants to. Not because the style tells him to, but because his muse tells him too. By the way, as a anticipation of things to come, the fourth movement will do away entirely with the classical era tenet, of good taste. But our vulgar bad taste is awaiting us. I hold that out as an apple for you. We'll get there soon enough. Movement two is also a sonata allegro form movement. It is rich, lyric, and glowing, a movement of great elegance and melodic variety, firmly within the melodically rich gallant style of classicism. Listen, I would encourage you to embrace it, revel in it, sing it, put it beneath your pillow, but do it on your own. We must sadly move on to other musical pastures. It's time to talk about the third movement and what the third movement represents more than just music. Is Beethoven's final destruction of the classical era minuet and trio. Oh, he would deny it if we had him here under a heat lamp and we'd say, Louis Van, it was the Second Symphony you destroyed the minuet and trio. He'd say, honest officer, it wasn't me, it wasn't me. It was him, it was the Second Symphony. Beethoven's assault on powder-wigged music is pretty much complete here. Beethoven doesn't even call this movement a minuet and trio, even though on paper it looks like one. He calls it scherzo. Scherzo. Now, scherzo means literally, I'm joking, or joke. Musically, the term scherzo has been in use since the 1600s, since the 17th century, and it's been used to describe music that is swift and light in character and often in triple meter. That means the beats are grouped in three. Beethoven's scherzi are typically fast to very fast. They have nothing to do with the courtly mood of minuet and trio, and adhere to the large-scale formal construct of minuet and trio only when it suits Beethoven's fancy to do so. Beethoven will not call another of his symphonic third movements minuet and trio, until the Eighth Symphony. And the Eighth Symphony is an homage, a looking backwards to the days of Haydn. And so Beethoven will call the third movement of his Eighth Symphony minuet and trio. But from here on out, he's going to call them scherzi or other things. Now, I'd point out, as a reminder, how minuet and trio works. Minuet was that dance that survived the Baroque era and was adapted into the instrumental compositions of the classical era. A minuet is a stately three-step dance that evolved first in the court of Louis XIV. The formula for a minuet in the classical era was that the first phrase would be stated and then repeated. A new phrase, we could call it Zeke, but I call it B, is stated, and a return to the original, B and A, and they are repeated. And that is the formula. That is the phrase structure. Then in a minuet, we hear a contrasting minuet, a new dance with a new melody, but the same inner phrases, C repeated, then D, C, D, C. And then a return, by the way, to the original minuet, creating a large-scale minuet trio, minuet form, or ABA. Okay, that's what Beethoven's going to joke on. That's his pun. Now, the particular form of this second movement scherzo resembles minuet and trio. The opening scherzo has two phrases which are repeated, then B, A double prime, and B prime, and they're repeated. So we see he still has phrases that are repeated, but they're not the formulaic phrases of minuet and trio. Likewise, Beethoven's trio section has a C section which is repeated, and then a D, C, C prime, and that's repeated. So he's not being dogmatic about these inner phrases. And then at the end, we have a scherzo da capo. Beethoven goes back to the beginning, and we hear the original scherzo again. So on paper, this might almost look like a minuet, but a minuet is by definition a courtly dance in a moderate triple meter. My question for you is, does the following excerpt of Beethoven's scherzo, A and A prime, heard in repetition, does this excerpt sound like a courtly minuet, like a courtly dance? This is kind of bouncing, weird schizo music. You know, does this sound like a courtly dance? Well, not unless they have a serious weevil infestation of their undergarments. Could anyone dance this way? I would read from your word scores, please. Scherzo, theme or motive? Three-note rising motive is uniquely scored. Each three-note rising motive is played by a different section of the orchestra at a different dynamic level. If you don't think this would have driven the players of Beethoven's time quite mad, then you're mistaken. It would have driven them nuts to have to play just these three-note units without connecting it into any long thematic idea and to constantly be changing dynamic from forte, from loud to piano soft, to forte, to piano, to piano, to piano, to piano, to fortissimo, very loud. Yo, that's hard to do for a band not accompanied to that, accustomed to that sort of transition. So we've got a very strange theme, which really consists just of a three-note idea, bouncing around like a ping-pong ball. We then move to phrase B. A more tunefully conceived phrase, though still a quirky one, appears in the violins. Phrase A double prime brings back our bouncing three-note motive. And phrase B prime, climactic and extended phrase, brings the scherzo to a ringing conclusion. Let's listen to this entire scherzo. Let's revel in its originality. Let's realize how difficult this would have been to play in a first performance, and how striking this would have been for an audience grown accustomed to the staid and stately minuets and trios of the classical style. Beethoven, third movement, scherzo. A prime. Repeat. A prime. B. A double prime. B prime. Repeat B. A double prime. B prime. It's brilliant and marvelous music, but very original music. I point out on your word score, we did not listen to the second movement, which of course is a sin, and at some place I will be judged for this, but you won't have to worry about that, providing you listen to the second movement on your own. I pointed out that the three-note rising motive that is the essential theme of the scherzo grew out of the theme of the second movement, which began this way. Second movement. This kind of how dry I am opening, well, it's the upper three notes that become the rising three notes of the following movement, the scherzo. So a motivic connection between movements unites these movements and gives a continuity and a wholeness that the piece would otherwise not have. All right, quickly, the trio. Charming, almost rustic tune assembled from three- and four-note rising and falling motives. So Beethoven continues to build on these rising and now falling three- and four-note musical ideas. We hear it in two oboes and two bassoons, and that would be phrase C. Then at measure 93, phrase D, a heavy, peasant-like, really almost crude, trill and arpeggio. The entire phrase sustains a single harmony, and that harmony is F-sharp major. If we had but time, we would talk about this remarkable leap from D major to F sharp major. This is like going from Washington, D.C. to San Francisco in 3 seconds flat. A huge harmonic distance traversed in a most interesting manner. Measure 107, sudden and unexpected octave A naturals blow away the key of F sharp major and pave the way for a return to D. Phrase C ensues, two oboes, two bassoons, and now two horns, and then phrase C prime. All of this repeated. Let's listen to the trio, please. D. C prime. Back to D. C. C prime. And if this was a true performance of this piece, we would then go from this point right back to the scherzo, and we would hear the scherzo again. It's called the da capo, the back to the top. But of course, when we go back to the top, we do not hear all the repetitions again. It's not necessary to go through the internal repetitions. Rather, we move without repetition through the scherzo, and that brings the movement to its conclusion. Now, a fascinating aside, and I must share this with you. As I mentioned before, Beethoven wrote two symphonies in the key of D. The Second Symphony of 1802 and the Ninth Symphony of 1824. 22 years separate these two works. But there's no doubt that a whole bunch of things that he wrote in the Second Symphony, because they were in the key of D major and D minor, stuck in Beethoven's ear. And when he sat down and wrote another D minor, D major symphony, he brought back many ideas first expressed here in the Second Symphony. For example, I demonstrated how that wonderful and dramatic descent in the introduction of the first movement is mirrored in the Ninth Symphony as the theme of the first movement. So I must point out another such event right here. C and C prime are in D major of our trio. We have pizzicato strings, plucked strings, descending in the bass, and we have the woodwind instruments playing the actual theme, which is rather rustic in nature. We're going to play that back-to-back with the trio section from the scherzo of the Ninth Symphony, 22 years later, which is also in D major, which has staccato, pizzicato-like bassoon descending in the bass, and the winds are playing the tune. Hearing these back-to-back, it's hard to tell that there's any difference whatsoever. Again, the ideas stuck in Beethoven's ear for well over two decades. First, phrases C and C prime from the trio of Symphony 2, and then the like section from the trio of Symphony No. 9. Symphony No. 9. I'll play this at the piano because there's one further thing I have to point out. Again, Symphony No. 2. Symphony No. 9, which of course turns two movements later into the Ode to Joy melody. So the Ode to Joy melody is being anticipated as early as the trio section of the Symphony No. 2 of 1802. I think that's really slick. I hope you do also. All right, a brief respite before we tackle this wonderful and vulgar fourth movement. Beethoven's Second Symphony was among the longest symphonies ever composed to its time, running about 36 minutes with all the proper repetitions. It initially received mixed reviews. I cannot resist reading you this review that appeared in the Zeitung für die elegante Welt, the newspaper for the elegant world. The symphony is a gross enormity, an immense wounded snake, unwilling to die, but writhing in its last agonies, and, in the fourth movement, bleeding to death. Oh, goody. Let's listen to it bleed to death, shall we? Now, we must put a new word score on the board, so let's break and come back with the fourth movement. Movement 4, Sonata Allegro form. Like Beethoven, let's get right to it. Theme 1 introduced without any flourish or introduction. Weird, comic, completely unconventional theme opens with a motive that seems downright nonsensical. Let's listen to the first 12 measures of this movement, phrases A and A prime, two times back to back. And what I want you to notice, what I want you to think about while you hear the opening of this symphonic movement is, does this sound like a singing, memorable symphonic theme, a tune, something that sticks to my melodic ribs? Not a bad question to ask. Theme 1. A prime. Immediately, let's listen to that again. Well, does anyone want to sing in whatever privacy this is being listened to, the opening idea? If you do, you're going to sound very odd and liable to bring the dogs in the neighborhood to your door. I'll play it at the piano. I'll play that again. That doesn't sound like a singing classical era tune. That doesn't have the clarity of line, the melodic flair, the flourish that one looks for in classicism. No, what can such a strikingly weird-sounding melody possibly mean? Well, let's get down and dirty, my friends. I would read from your word scores. Note, the opening motive indicated here is actually two ideas in one. A hick, and that's what we just heard. Hick. As in hiccup, burp, belch, or whatever. Followed by a groan of pain. Ow! Music, like life, is often not pretty. Beethoven's gastric problems, particularly in times of great stress, like the fall of 1802, were legendary. He was not a man to be trapped in an elevator with. Now, don't blame me. I'm just the messenger. I used this musical example in a previous course that I taped for the teaching company, and I've gotten any number of inquiries from usually slightly incensed people who want to know where I have it that I can come off talking about this theme as basically being a reflection of Beethoven's GI tract problems. Well, don't blame the messenger. It has been understood almost since the day of its premiere that that is what this music is all about. Beethoven never refuted it. In fact, he must have encouraged it, because otherwise, how would such an interpretation become common coin? And common coin it is. Yes, the fourth movement of Beethoven's Second Symphony is about his terrible gastric problems, which included burping and belching, stomach acid, flatulence, and other unmentionables, which I won't get into until we have to get into them at the end of the movement. Let's listen to theme 1 in its entirety, phrases A, A prime, and B. All right, let's talk briefly about the transition bridge theme and theme two, because these are the two other delightful themes in this wonderfully and marvelously vulgar movement. A transition bridge theme is used in lieu of a bridge. And this being a sonata form movement, we will have a second theme. All right, first I read from your word score regarding the transition bridge theme, which, as I say, is used in lieu of a more regular modulating bridge. This theme is everything theme one is not. It's smooth, it's lyric, it's melodic in a more conventional sense. This transition theme rises from the low strings to the high winds and distracts us momentarily from the rather crude opening of the movement. Let's listen to this transition bridge theme as it appears in the exposition. Theme two. Beethoven doesn't even need a theme two. If you want to know the truth, what we're really interested in, what happens to that interesting theme one. But he does write a sonata form movement and does feel the necessity of having a theme two, and so it is a playful, comic dialogue between long note descending motives in the winds and quick, scurrying responses in the violin. Let's listen to theme two in its entirety, phrase A and A prime, as it appears in the exposition. A prime. The lyric relief provided by this transition bridge theme and theme two, notwithstanding, this wonderful movement is about theme one. It is a movement that Roger Norrington, the really eminent English conductor, referred to as being vulgar and delicious. If we can put those two words together, it is apt here. So let's move on to the development section, which is pretty much characterized entirely by hicks, burps, and groans. It is a development in six parts, and we should note particularly part six. Gigantic, gut-wrenching hicks. Frankly, they are beyond hicks. They are erps at this point, if you'll forgive me. Alternate between winds and strings. Note, call the doctor. This sounds very serious in F sharp minor, a very serious key. And then, as quickly as it came, the attack passes. Two quiet, exquisitely comic hicks. Effortlessly redirect the key back to D major. Cancel the medical alert. Let's listen to the entire development, parts one through six. Part one, sounding like an exposition repeat, begins with theme one, but quickly gives way to part two, a rather serious for a change bit of music, based on the trilling, that is the groaning portion of theme one. Part three, a sequence based on the tail part of theme one, chattering comically as it does. Part four, a sequence based on the trilling, groaning portion of theme one. Part five, dramatic orchestral unison descent in the strings, leads to another louder orchestral unison descent, and then to our gigantic, gut-wrenching erps of part six. It is marvelous, it's engaging, it's comic music, it's Beethoven bringing himself out of the depths of despair, which he is emotionally suffering through at exactly the time he writes this movement, by writing a movement sure to please, sure to make us smile, sure to make he, Beethoven, laugh. Let's listen to the development, part one. Part two. Part three. Thank you. 5. Part 6. Recap. Oh, sadly, we must move forward to the coda. I wish I had time to go through this entire movement with you. It really, really is a scream, but we don't. It's a very lengthy coda in 9 parts, and even now we see Beethoven lengthening codas to the point beyond which they have been before him. Remember, coda means tale, and codas traditionally were, in the music of the classical era, extended final cadences, an opportunity for a composer to convincingly bring a movement to its conclusion. But that's what they were, extended punctuation marks, nothing more and nothing less. For Beethoven, codas, even here in the Second Symphony, are getting longer and longer. They're becoming very important pieces of composition, almost development sections unto themselves. And I would tell you when we get to the Third Symphony, written only a year after this one, codas do indeed become, in many ways, second development sections. So let's look at this long coda, lengthy in order to balance the long introduction that preceded the first movement. It is filled with ingeniously varied moods and musical variety, to say nothing, for great comic timing. I read from your word scores. Part 1, theme 1, a veritable gastric attack, an explosive series of hicks and ows spew forth. Part 2, transition bridge theme, dramatic and explosive, leading to a huge, loud, important-sounding open cadence, which is followed by a teeny-weeny, quiet, mysterious harmony, which directs the music in an entirely new direction. I would love to have time to read this entire word score for the coda to you, but I don't. We will listen to it. I will indicate what parts we are in. I want you to be aware the conclusion of this coda is rip-roaring and fire-snorting. We move to the end of the symphony with tremendous power and rhythmic energy, and we'll have some time to draw our proper conclusions after having listened to this marvelous finale. So, coda in its entirety, part 1. Part 2. Part 3. Excuse me, part 2. Part 3. Part 4. Part 5. Part 6. Part 7. Part 8. Part 9. Again, I would remind you for the last time that Beethoven is writing this movement exactly at the same time he was penning the Heiligenstadt Testament. Our conclusions? Well, they're the same conclusions we drew at the end of the first movement in terms of sheer length, dramatic scope, the nature of the themes, the degree of contrast, and personal, not generic, but personal expression. This symphony exists at the very outer edge of the classical style. With his next symphony, the third, Beethoven will enter an entirely new compositional and expressive world, a world into which he will eventually drag, kicking and screaming all the way, the entire Western European musical establishment. Until then, thank you.